Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
All right, we are back. We'll just keep going, keep riding this wave. We've got full phone lines, and if you get a busy signal when you call, just keep hitting redial, and I'll do my best to get you on the air with your comment or question. 888-914-9149. Let's go to, look at that. Ursula, I hope you're still listening. I was literally about to bring you on the air. I know you've been waiting for a while. And just as I was about to press on air, you dropped. Tisk, tisk. Well, if you want to call back, 888-914-9149. So let's go now to Carolina. Good morning, Carolina, in California.
Good morning. Hello?
Good morning. Yes, welcome.
Oh, my gosh. I'm so excited to be on the show. my
welcome.
First time caller, so. And I like how you said my name.
That's
too,
great.
Carolina.
Did I say it correctly or did I mispronounce it?
We usually just say Caroline, but, you know, cool people say Carolina,
okay.
So that's cool.
There you go.
Okay. So I had an original question, but I think you've answered it before, and then another question just popped in my mind. Do you mind if I ask you that?
No, go right ahead.
Okay, perfect. My Bible study, we're studying the book of Judith. And there's this one part where it explains that she's a widow and she lives like on top of her roof. She like has a tent up there and that's where she resides, after her husband died. Mm-hmm. And so my Bible study and I were just wondering why she did that, because we didn't see anywhere in the Bible or in that story that the reasoning behind it.
As to why she lived on the roof? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, as to why she lived on the roof. Instead of her house, in her house after she, mm-hmm. after her husband died.
That's a question I don't know the answer to. First of all, I've never thought about that, but I can tell you, I just want to look to see if I have, I can give you a source that may be able to give you more details if you're interested. So it's a book by Father Ken Baker, and it's called Inside the Bible. And what he does is he takes each book of the Bible, including Judith, of course, in the Old Testament, and he writes an entire chapter on it that gives you an overview. So here's who wrote it, here's when it was written, here's who it was written to, here are the significant aspects of this book, here's what happens, here's the theological takeaway, etc. And he also gives like a chronological timeline at the end of each of these chapters. So what I would do personally is you can get that book if you want. You can get it on, Kindle, if you want to get it cheap that way. So you can put the free Kindle reader on your phone if you want to. It's just an app that you can get for free. And then if you were to download the book, you'd have this kind of answer to every single book in the Bible. And I find it fascinating.
Wow.
But as far as that detail is concerned, I must confess, I don't know off the top of my head what the significance is of her living on the roof. But I'll bet you if there is some significance, he'll have something about it in that chapter on Judith.
Okay, awesome. Yeah, it was really just small significant detail, but it was just odd that she had her own house. She had her house, but she didn't really mm-hmm. live in it. She lived on the roof. And we were kind of speculating maybe she didn't want people, because she was so, you know, according to the Bible, she was like very beautiful and rich and wealthy, mm-hmm. and maybe she didn't want suitors or people coming to bother her or tempt her or something, because she was a very virtuous woman.
Could be that. Okay. If you go back to 2 Samuel, you'll read the story of King David, and he was out on the balcony or whatever of his castle, his palace, and he sees the wife of Uriah. So he sees Bathsheba, and where is she? She's up on the roof, as James Taylor would say.
Mm-hmm.
So she's up on the roof to take her bath, And the only reason that David saw her taking her bath was because he was up high as well. The average person would not have had that vantage point. So there may be something to that. And it was because that would have been an area of privacy for her to, you know, to bathe without prying eyes. Little did she know that King David was spying on her. Mm-hmm. But that could be actually maybe why Judith was living up there. I don't know. I'd have to study that, but that's an interesting angle.
Yeah, definitely. Awesome. Well, thank you so much. I know my Bible study.
You're welcome.
Excited to hear this question.
Tell them I said hello.
Offering the book. Awesome. We will.
Thanks, Catalina. Okay. Take care. Let's go now to, where are we going? Let's go to Susan. There she is. Susan in Austin. Thank you for waiting and welcome.
Thank you, Patrick. I am curious.
You're welcome.
If someone has an apparition or a vision of Mary, what are they supposed to do with that? Is it supposed to be a private experience, or are they supposed to share it in some way?
Well, assuming that it is authentic, and I think most people who imagine that they have a vision of Mary did not. It could be their own imaginations or something else. But if it's an authentic apparition, just judging from what other authentic apparitions have shown us, there is a kind of testing as part of it, but also waiting to see if this is something that Our Lady wants to be made known. So to use an example, in 1531, when Our Lady appeared to St. Juan Diego, and there were several different apparitions, at first, he was so startled by this first apparition that he chose a different route to go where he was going each day so that he would avoid seeing her again, because he was so startled by this. So he went around the hill a different way. She met him over there. It's like, you're not going to get away from me. I want to talk to you. So the testing can take that form, or the testing can be, you know, are you really the Blessed Virgin Mary? Because it has been known that the devil will sometimes appear in a counterfeit way, trying to appear as Jesus or Mary. And sometimes saints have been instructed by their spiritual director to ask the apparition to say, "Praise be the name of our Lord Jesus Christ," or something like that. And then if it's the devil, then that becomes apparent and he disappears. So the question of authenticity, I think, is the first, for me at least, that would be the first question mark. Now, then would be, if it is authentic and she says, "Go tell your bishop," all right, I'll go tell my bishop. And this is something that is usually, this is something that usually accompanies authentic apparitions. So she says, "I want you to do this. I want you to go talk to the bishop. I want you to tell the bishop this." That's typically the format that unfolds. And if that's the case, then I would follow that. But I would be really careful in, if something like this ever happened to me, and nothing like this has ever happened to me, but if it ever did, I would be really hesitant, because my first assumption would be this is coming out of my own imagination. And I would be less inclined to think it's an authentic apparition until it was proven that it was. So I would just offer that word of caution.
What if the apparition is to a child and the child knows who Mary is because they're in a Catholic school, but there's no message? She's silent.
Yeah, that's mysterious, isn't it? But it could be real. And I know that our Lord and our Lady do favor the little ones. Typically, it's children that she appears to, or just very simple people, but often children. I know, and you can look this up, Susan, if you're interested. It's available online. But Nancy and I spent a week in Paris back in the probably early 2000s. I was doing a lecture tour there. And we stayed at the home of this wonderful family whose daughter, her name was, I'm trying to remember her name, Audrey. Her name was Audrey Stevenson. She was a little girl. The father is French, the mother's American, but they've lived in Paris forever. And their little daughter would see her guardian angel and would see Mary. And I think Jesus even appeared to her. And she told them from the time she was little about she could see these things. And so eventually sort of worked its way up the food chain. And I believe even the local bishop spoke to her, and everything about this suggested strongly that that this was real. This is authentic. And she died as a child. She died of an illness. But I wouldn't be surprised if the cause of her canonization is underway. And when we were there for that week, we stayed in their home. And so we were able to hear the story directly from her parents and see, mm-hmm. you know, her mother would say, see, right here in this hallway is where often she would see Our Lady, or she would see her guardian angel. So it was very impactful for us to see that. But that's one example that I know of anyway that seemed real.
Well, could I just share with you the experience and have you decide what you think about it?
Well, I can offer a thought, sure. I can't really decide for anybody, but I can give you my impression if you'd like.
Well, while in second grade, I was attending a Catholic school. My family was starting to have, you know, breakdowns, and I eventually ended up in an orphanage for third and fourth grade. But in second grade, I had this vision of Mary. It was about 5 a.m, and I was not dreaming. And I closed my eyes and opened them again, and she was there. I closed my eyes again and opened them again, and she was still there. And I got so scared because I knew who she was, because I was in a Catholic school, that I put the covers over my head. And I'm sure that's not, you know, your typical reaction, but that's what I did. And I told my grandmother that morning what had happened. And I actually used the phrase the Blue Lady because I actually knew the phrase from being in Catholic school. And I said to her that I had seen the Blue Lady, and she was a devout Catholic and she didn't say anything. But it wasn't until I was in my 30s and I was in a Bible study, and the director said to me, "Don't you see what had just happened? Mary was trying to tell you that she would be your mother, and she is your mother." And I think it was during that transition that I couldn't believe that something like that would happen to me, but I've always been afraid to share it. And I don't know if that's my responsibility. Am I supposed to share it? Or is that some attention seeking business, you know?
That's a good question. I don't know if I have the answer for you, but I'm wondering, number one, did you said that this was silent, this apparition or whatever this was. So there was no sense in which she was saying to you, go tell your parents or go tell the bishop or the priest or anything like that, right? There was no message?
No, Mary said nothing. But I do want to tell you that I eventually went to work for a bishop in Florida, and I have been directly related with Relevant Radio for a long time. And now I live in Austin and work for a Catholic school here. But I almost feel like Mary has me on a mission, and I just can't quite figure it out.
Well, perhaps the best thing to do is just, first of all, in asking for Our Lady's intercession, just ask her if this really was you. Could be my imagination. Who knows what it was? But if it really was you, and if there's some purpose that you have in mind or that God has in mind for allowing you to appear this way, please manifest that to me, whatever it is, so that I will know what God's will is to do. I would pray that, first of all, and perhaps you already have been, and then wait and see. And maybe something will materialize, maybe nothing will. But I have to think, Susan, that when you consider all the many apparitions that have taken place that we know about, there are probably countless more that we never heard about because they were intended just for those people. But it wasn't intended to be propagated to the world. Some were, but I have to think that the majority of them probably are not. So perhaps this would fit in that category, but I don't know. And if you feel as though there's some reason to bring it up with maybe that bishop that you once worked for, get his impression, you know, you can always ask him about it or ask your parish priest. But that's how I would try to pray about it.
Okay. All right, Patrick. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Susan. Thank you. Appreciate that. Let's go to Joanne now in Hawthorne, California. Hi, Joanne.
Hi, Patrick. Patrick, I have two questions. The first one being, is the group, they're having, I was invited to a group confession. I don't know what they call it, but it's in the church. Pardon me?
Was it a penance service?
Yes, penance service tomorrow night. And I just want to know, is that the same, does that count as much as going to regular confession?
Well, one thing to be aware of is that if it's a penant service, and often, more often than not, this is how it's done, there would be a penance service, and there will be many priests there to hear individual confessions. So there might be 10, 15, 20, 30 priests, and they will be available for people to go to confession. That's the most common form that you'll see that. Now, in some cases, there will be what's called a penance service that involves general absolution, in which the priest might say, there's no time for me to hear all of your confessions, so I'm just going to grant you general absolution. You don't want to be going to that, because general absolution is reserved for very specific and extreme circumstances, such as, to use an example, let's say that we were in Ukraine and the Russians are bombing the smithereens out of where we are, and we could die at any minute with these missiles coming through the wall, you know, could kill all of us. So because it's an extreme situation, the priest could, if all the people were huddled in the church, he could say, I grant you all general confession. And the purpose for that is that you would have absolution in case you did die. So this is an example of where it's a very extreme kind of situation. But what the average Catholic doesn't typically realize is that if he or she goes to one of these services where the priest just grants general absolution, which they're not supposed to outside of these unusual circumstances, they're not supposed to do that. But even if they did that, they still have the obligation to go to an individual confession as soon as possible. So this is assuming that somebody had mortal sin on his soul. If he goes and the priest grants general absolution and he dies, well, he's been absolved of his sins. He's received the sacrament of confession. But if life goes on, well, that emergency measure no longer is necessary, and he still has to go to confession and confess whatever mortal sins he might have had on his soul. And one of the problems is that sometimes when a priest does this, he doesn't inform people of that. And so they think, oh, okay, I'm off the hook. I got a general absolution. And they don't realize that they still have to go to confession. So I would be on the lookout for that. Knowing your area in the Archdiocese of Los Angeles, that you're not likely to see that as a problem. More likely it will be a number of priests there to hear people's confessions.
Okay, that's great. Thank you. I appreciate that. And one other thing is the tabernacle has been moved to the side in this particular church.
Okay.
And is that right, or should that be in the middle?
Well, traditionally, the tabernacle has always been in the sanctuary in the center. You know, it's the custom of long standing. There were some spasms of attitudes, let's put it, on the part of many Catholic priests and even some bishops in the 70s and 80s, in which it was in vogue to move the tabernacle off to the side. For fear, and it was an ungrounded fear, but a fear that, well, the people will be confused because Jesus is on the altar, but he's also in the tabernacle. That will confuse people. No, it doesn't confuse people. Or they'll be confused because they're going to be thinking Jesus is in the tabernacle, but they're supposed to concentrate on Jesus' presence in the community. People are not going to be confused. If anything, I would argue those liturgists were the ones who were confused. But there was a trend for a long time of moving the tabernacle to the side. And that, of course, had the effect, whether it was intended or not, and I think in some cases it probably was intended, to minimize attention to and respect for Jesus and the Holy Eucharist. And it achieved that goal very nicely, because a lot of people thought, well, if it's moved off to the side, it's not really that important. And I think there is a cause and effect relationship between the rather rapid decline among Catholics in the United States, at least, in their understanding that Jesus is truly present in the Holy Eucharist. They actually, they began to not believe that anymore. And so there has been a great diminution of reverence for Jesus and the Blessed Sacrament, because many people just no longer realize that he's really there. They think it's just bread, or it's just a symbol. And therefore, if it's off to the side, yeah, okay, that's fine. So I'm always happy to see, and I have been happy to see, this trend in the last, let's say, 10 to 15 to 20 years of bishops mandating that the tabernacle should be moved back into the center of the sanctuary again. And parish priests who do that, they get permission from their bishops. And the trend has very much come back in that direction, and I'm happy to see that. So I'll have to leave it at that, Joanne. I've got to take a break, but thank you. And I'll be right back with more right after this.
Follow Patrick on Twitter, at Patrick Madrid.
Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. This hour is sponsored by Notre Dame Federal Credit Union. Get the best premiums and discounts, all without charging fees, through Mission Insurance Solutions, part of the Notre Dame Federal Credit Union family. Go to yourmissioninsurance.com. That's yourmissioninsurance.com.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
Okay, we are back. Not with a vengeance, but we are back. 888-914-9149. We'll go now to Randy in Youngstown, Ohio. Good morning, Randy.
Good morning to you, and I appreciate the call screener putting my call through because I'm going in a completely 180-degree direction.
No problem.
I have a visual picture to present to you, and this is why I believe the Catholic Church is a cult.
Okay.
Jesus is talking to Peter. He puts his index finger on Peter and says, "You are Petros." He then puts his index finger on his own chest and says, "Upon this rock I will build my church." And of course we know that the rock of ages is Jesus, not Peter. And that is just one of the reasons why I think the Catholic Church is a cult. I appreciate your taking me and allowing me to express my opinion, and I would like your response.
Happy to provide it. Thank you for taking time to call on that. So first thing I'll mention is that the Greek that you're alluding to in Matthew chapter 16 is a translation of what Jesus actually said in Aramaic. He did not speak Greek. It was written in Greek in the Gospel of Matthew. And Matthew, for that matter, may also have been written originally in Hebrew or Aramaic and then eventually translated into Greek. But in any case, the difficulty you're pointing to is simply one of the Greek translation. Because Petra is a feminine noun, it means rock, and Petros was never a word until Jesus applied it as a name to Peter. So the thing to notice here is that this is a translation into Greek of what Jesus said in Aramaic, and when he originally met Simon, this is in John chapter 1, he says, "You are Simon, but you will be called Kepha." And so what you'll find interesting here is that this, although he's told this to Simon early on in his, when he first met him, he actually fulfilled this by calling him rock. And this is what he did in Matthew chapter 16. So this first instance is found in John chapter 1, verse 41. He first found his own brother Simon and told him, "We have found the Messiah." And then in parentheses, you'll notice it says, which is translated anointed. So what this means is, Randy, that when John wrote his gospel, he included a Hebrew term, and he uses the Hebrew term in the Greek. So in the Greek, he's writing, "He first found his own brother Simon and told him, 'We have found the Messiah.'" He uses this Hebrew word, and then he translates it in this sentence for those who don't know Hebrew. And he says, which is translated Christos, which would be the Greek equivalent of the Messiah in Hebrew. Verse 42, "Then he brought him to Jesus. Jesus looked at him and said, 'You are Simon, the son of John. You will be called Cephas.'" And different translations will have it as Cephas or Kephas. And then again, he has a parenthetical comment saying, which is translated Peter. So he puts then Petros. Now he puts the Greek word, which, as I say, wasn't really a word. It was a feminine noun, but Jesus made it into a name. So when he says here in John 1, you will be called Kephas or Cephas, that's the Aramaic word for rock. So the reason that you're having this difficulty is because you're basing your argument on the fact that when it was translated into Greek, they had a dilemma. How do we call this big burly fisherman by a feminine name? It'd be like, you know, Roxanne or some other feminine version of the name Rock. So the Petros Petra argument fails. It doesn't make the case. I mean, you may have other reasons for why you think the Catholic Church is a cult, fair enough, but this is certainly not a good one. And the name that Jesus gave Peter is Rock, and he's referring to him when he says, upon this rock I will build my church. And what's interesting is that this understanding of Peter as the rock was what the early Christians believed. That's how they understood this passage. And it was only later that people began to deviate from the apostolic teaching and come up with other ideas like Peter was just a pebble or that Jesus was making fun of Peter or something like that. So I know you don't agree with any of those things, Randy, but that's how I would respond since you asked me to.
Well, I appreciate it. Thank you.
You're welcome. Hope you'll keep listening and call back anytime. Let's go to Peter in Sacramento, California. Hello, Peter.
Hi. Oh, I'm a chip off the old rock. the Exalted has a strong point about Jesus going down into the underworld and releasing mm-hmm. the captives, and I think it's a profound point, and it seems to be glossed over by the church, and then I never hear Protestants talking about that, and I was just wondering, you know, I know you mentioned in Luke the rich man and Lazarus as mm-hmm. an example of explaining this a little bit, but is there more scripture to that? And why does it seem to be so glossed over when it's a very profound point? Because Jesus died for our salvation, that's great, but he also, this thing, he went down and he released the captives, and mm-hmm. and if Jesus hadn't died for us, we'd be still going to this holding place. So mm-hmm. I'm wondering, well, why does this point seem to be glossed over?
Well, I'm not aware that it is glossed over. I mean, the Exultet is a famous hymn of praise and gratitude that is sung by the church universally around Easter time. So it's liturgically present in the church and has been for the longest time. I guess maybe I'm just missing I'm missing something. How is it being downplayed or ignored?
If you talk to people, and when I've mentioned it to people, they give me a glassy stare, like, what are you talking about? Jesus went to the underworld and opened. I'm thinking that from Adam and Eve on, Noah, the people that were going to heaven didn't get into heaven. They were in this waiting place in the bosom of Abraham and that sort of thing.
That's true.
But it just seems like most people just don't really understand how profound this is, and I don't know. It just seems I think something's lost here, and I was just wondering if the church couldn't more emphasize that or maybe explain it a little better or something. Mm-hmm. Probably the reason that this has come up is I'm a cantor, and 11 years ago in a previous parish, a deacon said he was going to be a permanent deacon, said he'd be out of town, and asked me to do the Exultet, and I thought there's no mm-hmm. way I could do that long chant the way it should be done, but I got all the CD and worked at it and did it. But since then, I've worked at it every Lent, and a couple of years ago at my parish, I was blessed with the chance to do it, and I've worked really hard to do it right, and because I think it's so beautiful, and it needs people need to understand it. So I've been going, and I'm again going to do it again this year, and going through the Exultet over and over again. It really hits me that this is profound, and I just think it's being lost, and I just wish the church would be more explaining it. But is there more scripture than just that Luke with rich man and Lazarus to explain this?
Okay, yeah, I forgot that part of your question. There is. So it's alluded to. So Jesus describes it in great detail in Luke 16, as you mentioned. St. Peter refers to it, although he doesn't give us much explanation for it. And let me just turn to that passage for you. So he refers to it twice. So he says in 1 Peter chapter 3, beginning in verse 18, "For Christ also suffered for sins once, the righteous for the sake of the unrighteous, that he might lead you to God, put to death in the flesh, he was brought to life in the spirit. In it, he also went to preach to the spirits in prison, who had once been disobedient while God patiently waited in the days of Noah during the building of the ark, in which a few persons, eight in all, were saved through water. This prefigured baptism, which now saves you. I always like to add that next line because it's an emphasis on the importance of the sacrament of baptism. But in any case, he mentions it there in verses 18 through 20. And then he alludes to it again obliquely in verse 6 of chapter 4. We're in 1 Peter, by the way. He says, "For this is why the gospel was preached even to the dead, that though condemned in the flesh in human estimation, they might live in the spirit in the estimation of God." So there he's referring to when Jesus went to Sheol, as he describes in the case of Lazarus and the rich man. He's referring to Jesus preaching the gospel to those righteous people of the Old Testament who were going to go to heaven eventually, but they had to wait for Jesus to die on the cross and then come get them and bring them to heaven. So those are two more passages if you haven't seen those before.
Okay. Well, anyway, yeah, and then we're talking to Protestants, they just don't have a clue, you know, and I thought, well, it's too bad because it's really important.
Well, I should think that some Protestants do. I mean, maybe many don't. Maybe they don't really think about it.
Well, I guess the ones I've talked to, they just, what are you talking about, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's okay. Not a topic that has been widely talked about, I'll grant that.
Well, But anyway, it seems very important to me because I've been going over it, and I just wish more people knew about it is basically what I'm getting at.
Got it. Well, I think a lot more people, after hearing our conversation, know about it now. So that's a good thing, Peter. Thank you. Let's go to Aaron in Cape Coral, Florida. Hello, Aaron.
Hi, Patrick. I was a fallen away Catholic for about 25 years.
Okay.
And I came back about 2.5 years ago, and every now and then I go to confession with some sins that I've forgotten. Mm-hmm. And I recently went to confession and talked about a patient that I believe I didn't do right by. And he told me as a penance to have a mass said for this patient as an unknown friend because it was so long ago, I can't really remember his name.
Okay.
And he said to go to that confession, to go to that mass. And I went ahead and scheduled it, but it's not until January 6th because I guess they have it all filled up until then.
Oh, you're talking about the intention. Okay.
Yeah, should I not go to communion until my penance is complete by going to that mass? Or
you can go to communion. Really, yeah, you can go to communion. First of all, it's good that you're attentive to wanting to do the right thing. That's really good. You can go to communion. And the idea is to perform your penance as soon as you're able to do so within reason. So let's say, for example, that you were at Mass and Mass is starting and a priest is still hearing confessions. And as Mass is starting, you go into the confessional and he hears your confession, gives you absolution, and you come out. And he's given you a penance that you're not able to perform then and there. You can still receive Holy Communion. So it's not as though you can't receive communion until you perform the penance. The ideal is to try to perform the penance as soon as you can within whatever time constraints you have. In this case, I think the best way to handle it would be to just simply cancel that, so to speak, reservation, if we want to use that term, and just find a priest in the area who can make that a mass intention. He can offer an extra mass for that intention. And the customary thing would be to give him a stipend as a thank you for his time, maybe $20. And you could have that taken care of probably this week. And then once you've fulfilled your penance, then that's over and done with. But you don't have to refrain from receiving communion in the meantime.
All right. Well, thank you. That's all. I really appreciate your show and Relevant Radio. You guys
Thanks,
have made
Aaron.
A big difference in my life. Thank you.
I'm so happy to hear that. Thank you. So just to recap, in line with what Aaron was asking, if you want to have a Mass celebrated on the behalf of, let's say, the repose of the soul of somebody who has died, as an example, all you have to do is approach a priest. It could be your parish priest. It could be a religious order priest, as long as a Catholic priest in good standing, and just say, "Father, would you be willing to offer a votive Mass?" That's what these are called. It's called a votive Mass. And that's the term comes from the Latin, which means that you are offering it specifically for somebody. And he may say, sure, I can say an extra mass tomorrow. And that'll be the intention of that mass. And as I say, the custom is, it's not a requirement, so don't get the wrong idea, but the custom is, by way of etiquette, is that if you're asking the priest to celebrate a votive mass for you, that you would give him a stipend as a thank you for his time. It's not required, though, but it's customary. Let's go to a break. I almost went to a call, but let's go to a break instead, and then we'll come right back to the calls. You're listening to The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
Welcome back to The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Have a question?
Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
So, young Thomas, this is Led Zeppelin. Do you like this?
Yeah, he sounds really good.
It's not a he, though. It's a they. It's a band.
Oh.
You probably don't know about them too much, do you?
Wait, it sounds like a guy's name, though. All right, who are they? Who's Led Zeppelin?
Who's in it? Well, Jimmy Page and John Bonham and John Paul Jones and the lead singer whose name escapes me. People are already writing me emails. It'll come to me. Anyway.
Is this your birthday present to me, teaching about Led Zeppelin?
It is. I was going to ask you, how old are you?
Oh, is that something I should mention on air?
Well, how old are you right now?
Right now?
Yeah.
Well, I just turned a year older today.
Yes, you did. A little birdie told me that today's your birthday.
Do you want to guess, Patrick, or should we
Robert
have the listeners guess?
Robert Plant. Oh, Sarah, that's right. She also came up with it. So back to your birthday. Thanks, Sarah. Back to your birthday. Happy birthday, young man, young Thomas.
Oh, thanks. Appreciate it. I'm blushing really hard on the other side of this microphone. You can see.
Are you doing it? I can see it. Are you doing anything special? Feast?
I'm running the show today, so that's pretty special. I feel like that's awesome. But after that, I mean, I don't know. I'm going to take a nice walk and hopefully have some dessert of some kind. And,
I have two scoops of ice cream.
Oh, I don't want to get fat over here.
A cake. Well, happy birthday, young Thomas.
Oh, thank you. Appreciate it. So how old do you think I am?
I'm going to guess you're 27.
27? Wow. Where's the button for correct answer? Because that was spot on. That was good. Wow, nice. Yeah. I am 27.
Well, you look younger, but I know a little bit about you, so I know that you're a little older than you look. But happy birthday.
Hey, thanks. Appreciate it.
Yeah, and everybody is sending you out good vibes on your birthday today. All right, let's see. Let's go to Rob in Alamo, California. Hi, Rob.
Good morning, Patrick.
Yes.
I was reading the synod documents, and it quotes John 2:27 as basically, I'll paraphrase, the faithful who are anointed as a group are incapable of erring in belief. And
what
wow,
passage are you in? There is no John 2:27.
Yeah, John 2:27.
Okay, let's see here.
I'm looking at it in the King James Version. But the anointing which you have received from him abides in you, mm-hmm. and you do not need that anyone teach you, but as the same anointing teaches you concerning all things and is true and is not a lie.
Oh,
and whatever.
You're in First John. You're not in the Gospel of John.
Okay,
I was
going to
say, you have a Bible that's got extra stuff in there that's not in the Bible. Okay, so do you want to be in 1 John or 2 John or 3 John? I think it's 1 John,
John
you want to be in. Okay.
1 okay. John and chapter 2, verse 27.
Got it. Okay. So this is one that comes up from time to time where people will say that this must mean, therefore, that St. John is saying that you don't need to be instructed by anybody because you already know the truth. Well, you'll notice that the whole point of 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John is to instruct his audience. So he doesn't mean to say that in an absolute sense that you don't need to be instructed. He's just saying that, you know, on these matters that he's referring to or alluding to, that you know the truth. It's not like you need somebody to tell you. So that's the point of it. He's not saying that you don't need to be instructed at all, otherwise he wouldn't be writing these epistles to them.
So my question is, though, the counselor the synod documents are quoting this as maybe a reason why we need to go out to the faithful, listen to them, and as a group, what they believe, I guess we have to follow, because it's the Spirit speaking to us. I mean, that's what the synod document is really saying.
Is that what you think?
Puzzling. Well, I'm actually reading the document right here.
I see. Okay. I thought you were deriving that interpretation. Well,
No, I'm reading it right from the document. This is a property which belongs to the people as a whole. A supernatural sense of the faith is the means by which they, whatever, and it's the bishops need to listen to this.
It's called the sensus fidelium. It's a venerable term for a truth that the church has always recognized, and that is that the faithful have a religious sense. It's almost like an internal guidance system where they can tell when something's not quite right. And so that is true. There is the sensus fidelium. And St. John Henry Newman wrote a whole book on the topic. It's called On Consulting the Faithful on Matters of Doctrine. So nearly 200 years ago, he wrote a tome elaborating on what you're referring to. The problem, though, is that if it's not properly understood, it could be used as a wedge device or even a cudgel to arrive at error by saying just because some people hold this view, that therefore the church needs to listen to them with an eye toward seeing if what they're saying is true. And that's not the meaning of this passage in 1 John 2:27. Because you can have people who say, well, I think that there should be same-sex marriage. And of course, there are plenty of people who are saying that nowadays. And just because they say that and because they think that and because they want that, that's not the sensus fidelium. That's not the authentic sense of the faithful. That is an aberration and a sin, quite frankly, that some people have embraced. And they want to, some people anyway, want to use this idea of the sense of the faithful to say, well, look, here are some faithful, and this is their sense about it, therefore the church should take this into account. Well, no, because the church knows very clearly that the paradigm of human sexuality, and I'm going to use this as an example of how people might try to misuse this. The church knows very clearly and always has that the paradigm for human sexuality and marriage is one man and one woman. And Jesus himself gave us this paradigm in Matthew 19. So the church has always recognized this, even if some people in the church would prefer to do something different. That's not the sensus fidelium. Now, let me give you an example of what is. So in the second and well into the third century, we see the rise of Arianism, which was a denial of the divinity of Jesus, and it entailed a denial of the Trinity. Well, this was something that the average layperson, even without having had some like really detailed theological explanation given to him, the faithful generally understood that Jesus is God. And so when Arius popped up and began to confuse many people, oddly enough, it was the bishops and many of the clergy, but primarily the bishops who went into heresy. They were the ones who fell into this denial of the divinity of Jesus. But as St. Athanasius points out, and he was writing around the year 250, he points out that it was the faithful, the average rank-and-file Catholic person, man or woman, who said, no, we don't believe that. We don't believe that Jesus wasn't God. So there's an example of where the people resisted an innovation. They resisted a heresy by saying, that's not true. So from the church's own history, we can see examples of that. And I would say, Rob, that we are witnessing another example of it right now, where the people who are saying, we're not going to have a change in the church's doctrine on human sexuality. We're not going to accept homosexuality and homosexual activity, more specifically. That is the authentic sensus fidelium speaking, in opposition to the craziness that's going on in some of the corners of the synodal process, like in Germany, for example. So it's not the people promoting homosexual activity or same-sex marriage, etc. They're not in any way showing an example of authentic sensus fidelium. It's the people who are resisting it who are, because they're the ones who are being consistent with the truth as it's been revealed to us and has been held continuously from the beginning. I'll leave it at that, Rob. Did you have a follow-up?
No, I guess just have to believe that the Holy Spirit's in charge and whatever the Synod comes up with. To me, it's basically like they're going after the people to take a vote, and I wouldn't want to take a vote in my neighborhood of Catholics derive what we believe, right?
Exactly. So, you know, it's not a committee decision as to what the church believes. We have to be faithful to what the positive faith has been. As it says in the Bible, the faith once for all delivered to the holy ones. So the faith has been given to us, the object of the faith, the doctrines of the faith, and it doesn't mean that we can't understand them more clearly or more deeply. That's part of the development of doctrine. But the development of doctrine, as you probably know, Rob, does not entail a reversal or a diametric change in meaning. That notion is condemned by Pope Pius X in Pascendi, the Syllabus of Errors, and other documents in which he says these are one of the hallmarks of the modernist heresy, which seeks to persuade people that doctrines can change in their meaning or things could be reversed. It meant this once, but now it means something else. Those are all condemned propositions, formally condemned by the church. So we live in interesting times.
If we were to see this come out of the Synod?
Well, then we would see an aberration, much like we saw with the Arian heresy. And St. Athanasius saying, you probably have heard the phrase, Athanasius contra mundum, which means in the Latin, Athanasius against the world. And his point was that even if the whole world went into heresy, he would still stand against it. And thankfully, there were bishops like him, not too many, but there were bishops like him who stood against the heresy that most of the other bishops went into for a time anyway. Here's another example, Rob. In the time of the English Reformation, so-called, under King Henry VIII, every single Catholic bishop in England and Wales went into heresy except for one. That was Bishop John Fisher. He stood fast. He was the only one who refused to go into schism and heresy, and he was martyred for his trouble. But every other bishop, they folded when the pressure was on. So it's happened before. This is not a new thing. It's happened before. I hope it doesn't happen again.
Thank you, Patrick.
You're welcome. Thanks, Rob. Let's see. How about Therese in Arizona? Hi, Therese.
Hi, Patrick. I have a friend who is a Mormon, and they do a big Easter pageant here in town, and she invited me to go. Is this something I should do or not do?
Well, this is an Easter pageant that's put on by the Mormon Church?
Yes, yes. Okay. It's outside. They have live animals. It's kind of a big deal here.
Yeah, can you imagine?
But
what's that?
He is Mormon, and
Okay. Obviously
I'm not.
Yeah, I would say this. If you wanted to go as an observer because you're curious to know what they say about this, that could be one thing. I wouldn't advise it because these types of events are also carefully crafted so that the missionaries are out in force so that they can try to proselytize you. So I know that there's a lot of sincerity there, and I don't doubt the sincerity of the people. But remember that they don't believe in God the way we believe in God. We believe in one God in three persons, and we believe that God is God from all eternity. There is no other God. There are no other gods. Mormons believe that God the Father was once a man on a planet who had a God above him, and that he evolved into becoming a God. You can read a sermon that Joseph Smith wrote in 1844 called the King Follett Discourse. You should look that up, the King Follett Discourse, where he teaches this Mormon doctrine of the exaltation in how God evolved from being a man. And so Jesus is not part of the Trinity. He's just a separate God. Boy, I wish there were more time, Therese. If you want to call me tomorrow. We'll discuss it then.